The same thing happened in the Great Depression, by the way, because the start of the thing was the contraction in the money supply, and then the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were put in, and that really did a job on the whole thing. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch, just like we have now.
Professor Steve Hanke, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm great, Andy. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on. I said this last time, and I'll say it again. I don't mean to embarrass you. I'm such a huge fan and an avid reader of yours for a few years and consume all the content I can about you when you talk. And I'm very selfish with you in the sense of I want to spend as much time as with you as I can. My question really is we're getting all of these, I don't want to say conflicting economic signals, but conflicting to me, I'll say that. Where are we at in the economy and the economics? Are we slowing down? What's your opinion on all of this and what does all of this mean?
Well, Andy, the economy is slowing down as I've anticipated it would slow down. And the reason for that is really twofold. One is something that happened 2.5-3 years ago or started happening, and that's a contraction in the money supply in the United States. And that really is, until a couple of months ago, actually the money supply was, the stock of money measured by M2 was actually less than it was in April of 2022. So there has been a contraction. Now the money supply is growing, but it's only growing at a rate of 4.5% per year. And also credit in terms of bank loans, banks, of course, produce most of the money. That's not surprisingly, it's growing pretty slowly at 4.5% per year. Now, when I say slowly relative to Hanke's golden growth rate, which is 6.3%, and that's a rate that's consistent with hitting a 2% inflation target over a long period of time. So, and that's based on a quantity theory of money, just solving, putting the right numbers in for the equation of exchange and solving the thing. That's how you get the golden growth rate. So that was the slowdown is kind of baked in the cake in the sense that if you get a substantial change in the money supply, then with a lag of a couple of years, you start getting an effect on the real economy and real economic growth. So that's part of the picture that has nothing to do with who's in Washington, what's going on today. It all happened a couple of years ago. And that's a contraction in the money supply. Now, that's only happened 4 times, those contractions like that, and since the Fed was founded in 1913. So what happened? In each one of those, you had a big recession. One, you actually had a Great Depression. 1929 to 1933, the money supply contracted dramatically. And of course, we had the Great Depression. So that's part of the slowdown. The other part of the slowdown is the result of the new Trump administration and its activities, not only with regard to trade, but many other things are changing or proposing to change. And that creates what's called regime uncertainty. And we've only really had that one other time in the United States. That's when Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Dealers, came in. They were changing everything. You know, they remember the gold clause even was removed, and you had massive theft basically going on, and they wanted to stack the Supreme Court and added all kinds of new agencies, bureaus. Everything was changing. And as a result, there was regime uncertainty. It wasn't the uncertainty that's normally associated with this thing or that little thing. You know, those kinds of things are all over the place all the time. This is when you just change the regime. The rules of the game are just generally you throw out the old ones and put in new ones. So what happened then, back to the new dealers, there wasn't any new investment in the U.S. economy from 1929 until World War II started. So you had a much deeper depression, and the duration of the depression lasted much, much longer due to the new dealers. So you can kind of forget what you're reading in the history books, because it's not right. What's right is that the new dealers actually did a bad deed, because they created this tremendous regime uncertainty. So we have that going on, and that's added to the normal aspect of a slowdown associated with a lag after there's substantial changes in the money supply. So it's slowing down, and the thing that throws most people off, they're data dependent, including the Fed, by the way, and all of Wall Street. They look at the daily data, what's happening today, and they try to decipher which way the economy is going. And all that current data, most of it is just symptoms of what happened to the money supply a long time ago.
Right.
So they have no theory of anything. They're just looking at data. It's like putting your finger in the wind and trying to figure out which way the wind is blowing. So one day it's going one way, other day it's going another way, another day nothing's happening at all. It's very confusing if that's what you're doing.
Yeah, it confuses me. it doesn't confuse me, because I see it anecdotally that things are slowing down. And what I mean by that is just businesses where I live in Atlanta here, shutting or whatever, or my wife's business not being as busy as it was really 6 months ago, or really in 24. But I guess with all of this, and then you add on Trump's tariffs. So it looks like, and again, please interject, we're in a environment where we have higher prices and a slowing down economy, which is terrible for the middle class and the consumer.
Well, yes. Now we did get the inflation number came out today. It was 2.7%. It was exactly where it was the month before. That's way below the consensus. Everybody thought the number was going to be higher. I did. Because inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. That's mm-hmm. the basic thing. Now, tariffs can have an effect, kind of a one-time pop up, and then things start trending as they were before, and that trending is a result of what was happening with the money supply, a year or two prior to today, or whatever the date happens to be that you're looking at the thing. So I wasn't too surprised. And inflation is that trending down. It's coming down, and it's again due to the substantial reduction and contraction that we had in the money supply.
All right. So you mentioned money supply. Well, I don't want to say to mention in this conversation, but I'm going back to our previous conversation. Money supply has to be at or above inflation for the economy to grow. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, it is, in the sense that by definition, that's true. Nominal GDP is what? It's the real rate of growth in the economy plus inflation.
Right.
So if the money supply is growing less than inflation, by definition, the real rate of growth has to be negative.
Right.
So it's basically just an accounting identity.
So there is
that relationship. You have nominal GDP and you have inflation, and then whatever the residual is after you subtract inflation from nominal GDP is what the real rate is, what the real rate of growth is.
Okay, so let's take a the number you gave me, 4.5% of the money supply, that's where the money supply is at currently, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then inflation at 2.7%, the inflation numbers come out. So that would be, talk to me about that. So
add those two numbers and you get nominal GDP.
So we should be on over 7%.
Yeah, no, nominal GDP.
Nominal GDP. So we should be growing at a healthy clip then.
Well, we're growing at just what those numbers are.
Okay. Got it. And do you see that is the reason why
let's back up. I think we got some things mixed up there. I maybe misspoke. 4.5% is the rate of growth in the money supply. That affects nominal GDP, but that's not part of the number. Nominal GDP is the 2.7% inflation plus the current real rate of growth in the economy. Those are the two numbers you want. The 4.5% is the money supply, which that causes changes in nominal GDP. And if you use the quantity theory of money, of course, that is the model for national income determination and determining where nominal GDP is actually going. So the 4.5% gives you some idea of what's going to come down the pike in a year or two with nominal GDP, and that includes inflation and the real component.
Okay.
So there was a little mix up in what we said earlier. I agreed to what you said over 7%, but that's not right.
Okay. So then let's talk about expectations then in the next 18 to 24 months then. Do you expect then this to continue, meaning the growth rate to continue to contract based on everything that we just discussed about?
Right. We've had in the past a big contraction in the money supply, and there was actually an overhang from the ballooning up of the money supply, so that the cash balances in the economy were very unusual and very high. And when I say cash balances, that's the M2, the money supply. If you divide the nominal GDP into that, you get the cash balance. It's just the inverse of the velocity of money. And that number was very high. There was a huge, the Fed goosed the money supply, and there was a huge cash balances that everybody had. And they worked those off. And now it's back actually a little below the trend level. And the current injections of money coming in is only at 4.5% per year. So it's pretty slow. So all of this indicates, again, using the quantity theory of money, that things will slow down. And then you have all this regime uncertainty that Trump is throwing into the picture, which will slow things down. And the same thing happened in the Great Depression, by the way, because the start of the thing was the contraction in the money supply. And then the Smoot-Hawley tariffs were put in, and that really did a job on the whole thing. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch, just like we have now. Of course, the money supply contracted a lot more in the Great Depression than it has prior to today. That's one thing. And also, the Smoot-Hawley tariff actually is more or less what looks like the general tariff level is going to be with Trump. I mean, so Trump's tariffs are very radical.
Yeah. But you tell me about it. It's anywhere from 10-15%, seems as a baseline, to as high as 40 or, 140% if you pertain that.
No, well, if you look at the weighted average of the whole thing, it's just a tad over what it was with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. So it's very, very significant and way out of line with what was going on, what's been going on, because the effective tariff rates have been coming down for decades. Mm-hmm. and were basically de minimis. I mean, the overall weighted average is something like 2% or something like that. Very, very tiny. And the tariffs, of course, there are many reasons that the tariffs slow things down, but one reason is that they're the biggest sales tax increase on Americans that we've ever had. In fact, one of the biggest tax increases we've ever had. People don't talk about that.
No.
Trump likes to let people think foreigners pay the tariffs. Foreigners don't pay. If you import something, Andy, you pay.
Consumer pays.
Well, yeah. Let's put it, to be precise, the importer pays.
The importer pays, yeah.
The importer pays. And then what the importer sometimes is imports are sold directly to consumers. Other times they're sold as intermediate inputs into some production process or something. I mean, you could be importing screws or something, and they're sold to somebody that uses screws to manufacture something.
Right. So, with all of this information here, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like Trump's making the same mistakes as Roosevelt did, or really going into the Great Depression.
Yes, I would characterize it that way in general, although the kinds of things the New Dealers were doing with the exception of the tariff aspect. But, and the Smoot-Hawley tariff actually came from Congress. So you can't put that really on the back of the New Dealers, say. But everything else the New Dealers were doing, revamping the whole idea of government, all the rules governing business and antitrust and regulations, all of those things.
Yeah, I really appreciate how you framed it. It makes me think, because what we're getting now out of the administration is like, everybody asks, how are we going to pay for all of this, these new programs? And I don't think they've cut really any programs. They cut some, but anyways, they want to pay for a bunch of stuff. Well, the tariffs will pay for it, but it sounds eerily similar to all of the social programs and different programs they had that the New Dealers were putting out in 29.
Yeah, It is similar, and of course name one tax that ever stimulated anything. They drag things down. I mean, if you sell me something, Andy, and I'm willing to buy it, pay the price, and so forth, what there are gains from trade. That's what economists call gains from trade, because Andy benefits, or he would have never sold to Hanky, and Hanky benefits, or he never would have bought the stuff. And now the government comes in with a tariff, and what's the tariff do? That eliminates some gains from trade, and that revenue goes into the U.S. Treasury to finance the government. And it interrupts, certainly at the margin, with trade, and stops trade, because the marginal traders, let's just assume our exchange was done where there were very thin margins. You benefited very little from selling, and I benefited very little from buying. And the tax could be greater than those gains you had and I had. And then if that was the case, that the trading between us would stop.
Right.
It wouldn't continue. So that's in a kind of a simple-minded way. That's what goes on with tariff. It's a sales tax.
Yeah.
And huge sales tax, by the way.
Yeah.
There aren't states that have sales taxes that are that high.
No. Well, maybe California. But yeah. No, I live in Georgia, and it bounces between 4% and 7%, which 7% is still very high. Let me ask you, this is obviously, just from an investment standpoint, a trading standpoint, this is not obviously good for equities. And And again, going back to similar, and I'm not trying to project too much, but I remember if you go back in 28 and 29, you had this huge massive rush. The last part of that leg was a blow off top. And it seems eerily similar again today, again, not making a prediction, that you're having this blow off top here with really just a handful of stocks holding up the market.
Well, that's true. I have a bubble detector that I use, calculate whether the market's overvalued, undervalued, so forth. So that bubble detector is as high as it's ever been. And that suggests that the market is in bubble territory. But the big problem is that I can measure a bubble and I can tell you everyone that's ever occurred. The thing is, I can't tell you one of two things. I can't tell you, one, whether the bubble's going to pop, or whether normal valuations will be reached again by air just slowly coming out of the bubble over time. So I don't know if it's going to pop. I don't know if air is going to come out slowly. And I have no idea when it's going to start. So you can measure where we are and anticipate some of that air is going to come out, but when and how, there's no way.
Well, I had your friend Dave Cullum on yesterday, and we actually talked about that, and we made the analogy actually to the Soviet Union, and he's a deep valued guy in measurement and his own portfolio. And it was like, this can go on for decades. Things can go on for decades. We just never know what it will stop, or as you alluded to, when the air will be let out. But the thing is that it stopped.
Right. The markets will adjust, but exactly when the adjustment starts and the modalities and course that it will take, it's you can forget it.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit. I was talking to, again, Dave yesterday, and I want to make sure I get this correct. The video is dropping tomorrow. But he mentioned you and alluded to that you're the currency guy and knowing your background in currencies. And I want to weave BRICS into this. And he says BRICS is not about currencies. It's about contractual, and I'm paraphrasing here, obligations between companies that want to trade. Can you comment about that? And what is your opinion on the BRICS, and how does the BRICS fit into all of this in the new global economy?
Well, first of all, I agree with my good friend Dave Cullum that they BRICS is, think of it this way, it's kind of a talk shop right now,
right?
And I think with Trump and the tariffs, it will evolve more into something substantive that pushes back, because the BRICS, they think they're under attack, and they are, because if you look at some of the BRICS countries, they're sanctioned. Now, sanctions are just a weapon of war, and I would argue that tariffs are certainly secondary tariffs are also a weapon of war. So the BRICS are being attacked by the United States. That's what's going on. And the United States, Uncle Sam is not following. Uncle Sam, their current Uncle Sam in the White House, certainly hasn't read Dale Carnegie and doesn't know how to win friends and influence people. He's making a lot of enemies. Number one on that list would be probably India, maybe two, the European Union, but definitely India. And I think BRICS, especially you're having Prime Minister Modi will go to see Chairman Xi in China. It's the first time the Indian Prime Minister has even gone to China in 7 years. He's going in the next couple of weeks. So that gives you an idea that they're trying to figure out how to circle the wagons and integrate themselves in a more effective way. So you can see, I think, a stronger link between Russia, China, and India, which are, you know, three big countries, obviously huge geographic and pretty big economically. So I think the talk shop will become less talk and more action. But right now, back to the currency thing, they've been talking about a BRICS currency, but they don't have any plan. I don't think they know what the word plan means. I mean, they're talking about setting up a commodity exchange, for example. But in fact, if you look under the hood, they don't have any plan, and they haven't even decided if they have a commodity market, where will it be located? What town? What country? How will it operate? I mean, so it's a lot of gas.
Right.
But I think very significant, because the attack that Uncle Sam has placed on these members of BRICS, or the Global South, if you want to put it that way, they do feel like they're under attack, and they are under attack with the weaponization of tariffs and the imposition of sanctions and the weaponization of the U.S. dollar. So they I think, will move more towards proactive, or shall we say, counterattack.
So what does that look like? Is it just an attack of shipment of goods and trading goods, or is do you going to currency? Do you think that is an attack on currency?
Well, I think ideally, from their point of view, if I was recommending anything, I'd say, you know, they should just form a huge pre-trade zone amongst themselves. So do more and more business amongst themselves, and you know, if they do business with the United States, fine. But if you know, I wouldn't worry that much about it. You know, the old Napoleon line, the best defense, you never interfere with an enemy when the enemy is making all kinds of blunders and mistakes.
Yeah.
But so I think BRICS should stick to their own knitting. Stop talking so much and start doing, and integrate into a more free trade block, and just sit on their hands vis-a-vis the United States. I would wait, because, by the way, the United States, as it slows down and probably goes into a recession, that means that the United States will have a much weaker hand.
Yeah, right.
Than they have today. So that might change the picture substantially.
Got it. So in this world that we're talking about, not only BRICS, but also a slowing down of the U.S. economy, what is gold in all of this? It's had such a great run here for the last 25 years, which people don't realize, but more significantly, the last several months, if not probably 18 months. Do you see gold coming in as a holding currency? Do you see gold, is the gold run over? What are your thoughts on that?
Gold, as Nobel laureate Bob Mundell used to always say, maybe gold is not de jure, but part of the international currency system since 1971, when Nixon shut the gold window, but de facto, it is, and you're never going to get rid of it. It's going to stay in, and it'll. I haven't been bullish on gold, so I think it'll continue to go up as far as price goes. So, its importance is certainly not diminished, but enhanced by all these regime uncertainty and the things that we're talking about.
Yeah,
the more you weaponize the U.S. dollar with sanctions. That's been going on for some time, by the way. There's nothing new. But the more sanctions you have, and now tariffs, secondary tariffs, reciprocal tariffs, all of these things enhance the attractiveness of gold. because and it does that because gold happens to be something that, number one, has been a currency for thousands of years, but also it's not issued by a sovereign. It's not a liability of any sovereign. So and that's why I have recommended countries like Iran, Turkey, Russia. I never have explicitly mentioned China, but Iran, Turkey, and Russia should definitely, I think, establish currency boards that issue a local currency, but it's backed 100% with gold and trades at a fixed exchange rate with gold. So the local currency becomes the clone of gold. And it would be attractive for them, not only in terms of the kind of monetary stability that it would ensure, but also the anchor would not be the US dollar or the euro or the yuan or something else, some other fiat currency. The anchor would be gold. So you'd in effect go on kind of a quasi mini gold standard.
Do you think that's realistic and that would happen?
Well, I'm not saying it's unrealistic. They've talked about it. I wrote my proposal up. I think the first time I wrote that was a column in Forbes magazine. I think I've also written it up in National Review, but at any rate, that's neither here nor there. These countries have met and talked about my proposal. I know that. So it's been discussed.
That's music to my ears. One thing I want to touch on. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I would say it would be more beautiful music if they actually did something.
Right? Well, you know, stranger things have happened. I have this theory that I'm working out in that the world is actually going to get smaller, if you would, and the nation states are actually going away as we know them, if you were. And what are your thoughts on that? And they could be, they're using the dollar as an instrument, as the medium of exchange as of now, or they could be using gold or their own currencies. It actually doesn't really make a whole lot of difference to me. But my question is, where are you at with that theory of like that, what is actually going to be more local, if you would, or more, regional, if you would, the world economy?
Well, that's what's going on now.
Right.
You know, it's being fueled by this, all the weaponization of the U.S. dollar and Trump's tariff policies and that sort of thing. So it is moving in that direction. And the problem is once you move in that direction to dial the whole thing back, it takes time. So right now we're going in that direction. How far we go, I don't know. But yeah. but once you end up at kind of the end point, then the question is, well, how do you unwind the thing and start going the other way? Well, if history is a guide, it takes a while to unwind things like that.
Yeah, right. So you emailed me to all my viewers and listeners. I got an email from you about a book that was written about your life. And it was actually, I'm about halfway through it. I'd like to discuss that, if you would. If you could tell all our viewers and listeners, where did your journey, and again, I'd say this almost, I know the answer, but where did your journey really start? And how did you get into this business, if you would, of global macroeconomics and even projecting and fund and everything?
Well, the things that really started, I grew up in rural Iowa and went to the university had nothing to do with global currencies, but it had a lot to do with global markets in a way, because what do you produce in Iowa? You produce agricultural products, and a lot of those are traded in international markets, particularly soybeans. Obviously corn too, corn and soybeans. So two big grains. So that is one aspect. And then went to the university, and that was so much global, but jumping way ahead then to 1985, I had written an article in Barron's, and the article was about the Austrian business cycle. It was a business cycle, and it happened that one of the readers, Dr. Albert Friedberg, had trading a commission. He's a commission merchant in Toronto. Commission merchant meaning trading foreign exchange and commodities. And he invited me up for lunch. We saw eye to eye. He was viewing things through kind of an Austrian economics, free market lens, and trading, and invited me to join the firm at that time as a chief economist. And then I ended up, by the time I retired from Friedberg, being chairman of Friedberg Mercantile Group. And during that time, that one of the first trades actually that I was involved in, I'd analyzed OPEC. This is in 1985. And I did a little, as I call it, plain vanilla model of OPEC. And the model indicated to me that OPEC was going to collapse and the oil price would collapse. And I predicted it would go down below $10 a barrel. And
great call.
And it was a great call. It all happened at early 1986, shortly after we took these positions, which were quite substantial at the time. So that's the kind of trading aspect trading had. And in the meantime, of course, I've been a professor at Johns Hopkins University for now. I mean, like actually this fall, starting my 57th year. So, and the Hopkins part of it, I mean, I first arrived in 1969, but I was doing really microeconomics and systems analysis. It had nothing to do with international. It was all working on water resource kinds of problems, designing water systems, wastewater systems, water management, water conservation, figuring out what the optimum pipe size should be for a system, stuff like that. So the international thing really came precisely with Friedberg's, but a little before that, because when I was on Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, I was doing international things. So I'd say that the tipping point really going into professional international things was more or less 1981, something like that, early 80s.
So for all of our viewers and listeners don't know, and I don't mean to embarrass you, Professor Hanke, Professor Hanke's had some great calls, and I'm very familiar with your work and being in the Reagan administration. I have two questions about that. What got you interested in Austrian economics? Was there an event, or was there an experience, or was it just doing the work and then you thought, well, this is what's working? And then the second question really pertains to the Reagan administration. How much did they listen to you? How big of an impact did you have?
Well, the first thing, the Austrian economics, the first real introduction was one of my professors, Fred Glahey. He wasn't teaching Austrian economics. He was actually teaching, you know, pretty standard macro theory and econometrics. He was mainly the professor of econometrics, but he was working a lot on Austrian economics, and he ultimately wrote a book, by the way, on the Austrian business cycle. So it was Glahey, that would be in, you know, the let's say the mid to late 60s. And then kind of Mrs. Hankey and I both started getting interested in it in kind of the late 70s. And it was fitting in the way I was generally thinking about things. But and I dabbled a little, you know, everybody was reading like The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek and so forth. As it turns out, Hayek, you know, one of the leaders, turned out to be a family friend. And
that's great.
I think one of the apples in his eye was happened to be Mrs. Hankey's aunt in Vienna. So anyway, that's all a long story, but it just kind of kept building after the first kind of introduction with Glady, and then it's kind of on the back burner, and then another big chunk of kind of the late 70s, early 80s, about that time, with Reagan, and then jumping into the Reagan thing, there were actually two things that they list a lot about. One, it happens, as I told you, when I arrived at Hopkins, I was in with the sanitary engineers in an engineering department. My appointment was in an engineering department. So I knew quite a bit about water resources. And as a result of that, people in the Office of Management and Budget, Dave Stockman, Larry Kudlow was chief economist actually at the OMB at the time. They got wind of this, and finally Reagan assigned me to review all the proposed federal water projects that came down the pike and reevaluate them and give my opinion. And my opinion was all of them were turkeys, and none passed on my watch. None were approved. So that was one thing. The larger thing, however, was privatization. That's part of the work I'd even done in graduate school on natural resources, and public lands are huge in the United States. That's lands owned by the government, and lands owned by the government, the surface area of those lands is about six times larger than the land area of France. So they're huge. Almost all of Western United States, most of it's owned by the federal government. So we had a privatization initiative, and I designed that, and in the fiscal 1983 budget, if people want to read President Reagan's budget message, it has a paragraph in there that I drafted on disposing of what they called surplus land, surplus assets of all kinds. So it was kind of a precursor of, you know, Elon Musk and Doge. And that's basically what we were trying to do. We ended up we accomplished very little by way of selling the surplus assets. And I think the main accomplishment of that exercise, I ended up writing a couple books on privatization. Actually, the entry on privatization at the four-volume Palgrave Dictionary, which is the kind of gold standard for encyclopedia or dictionary in economics, is I wrote that entry on privatization. But the real interesting thing is that the first time privatization was used at a public address, I used that, and the title of my talk was Privatize Those Lands, and I delivered that speech in Reno, Nevada, and where did I get the word? I had some clunky thing in my speech. I gave it to Mrs. Hankey, and she says, "Oh, you're talking about privatization." She said, "Use privatization." I used it, and then everybody's coming down on me saying, "Well, Hankey, you're using some word that isn't even in the English dictionary," and it wasn't, because Mrs. Hankey's a Parisian, and it's a French word. But so we ended up. The big accomplishment of that whole privatization effort was that Mrs. Hankey and I lobbied to get the word privatize entered in the Webster's Dictionary. And in 1983, the Webster's Collegiate was the first English dictionary. So at any rate, that the Reagan year was actually quite productive in a way, that because they did realize I had expertise in water resources, and they gave me that portfolio, and they also realized that I had expertise and knowledge about the natural resources and the public lands, and that grew into the whole privatization movement.
Got it. So a few, and this we'll end on this, but really a question is, so you're at Hopkins and you've been there for 50 years. Do you students or your students, are they, yeah, how do you, I guess, and this is a very general question. Are they really receptive now to free market enterprise in this day? Yeah,
I don't exactly teach it like that.
But they got to know you.
Yeah. Well, we run what's called Hankey's Atelier, Hankey's Workshop. And the main thing I do, I teach them how to actually do things. So there's not, they probably get indirectly free market orientation, that kind of thing. But they know how to make calculations. They know how to value companies. They know how to do spreadsheets. They know how to do a lot of things. And as a result of that, they have a huge edge over everybody entering the job market. And my students all end up with their top jobs on Wall Street.
Yeah.
So I think if you're preaching, you know, free market economics, let's say, I don't think you'd get very far.
Right.
But so I get a long way by teaching them how to make calculations and how to, a couple of things. One, how to professional behavior. This is a big thing, because most young people, they have no idea what professional behavior is. And so I teach them what that is. I teach them what I call a precision drill. A lot of what they draft up, for example, I give content, they'll draft a tweet for me. Well, I edit the tweet ultimately, and I've got, you know, the third highest following on Twitter of any economist in the world, 806,000 followers. So I can't have a mistake. There can't be a one decimal point off. So they learn the precision drill, and they learn the five P's: prior preparation prevents poor performance. And they learn that I only like to use primary data. I don't like to use secondary sources. I like to go to the primary source. And they know how to write things in such a way that they can be replicated. In other words, if they write a research memo, they give it to Andy, and he can replicate the thing. Everything is there that you know. So that's what I'm teaching them how to do.
Yeah. So, and then they get it really exposed. I would say, I don't want to say through the back door, but they get exposed, I think, by just doing that. If you,
oh, they get exposed because obviously they read everything I'm writing.
Right. Just Google yourself. Just Google.
So in that sense, maybe some of it, the free market orientation thing comes through the back door, kind of maybe through osmosis. But the main thing, I train them to be in a position where they're productive almost within the day they hit Wall Street, and the employers, I have 100% locked. If I write a recommendation for a student, they get their job. There's no question about it. And the employers always react, and I always find out from them, they say, oh, Joe Blow was just great. You know, after 10 days, you know, we didn't even have to invest any time to train the guy. He could do stuff right away. And by the way, this is a huge cost most firms on Wall Street, because the training time is huge, and most students are completely unproductive.
I mean, in general, I
get this from talking to my students that I'm training, and their peers. They tell me, you know, where they're at and what's happening. And there's a big difference.
Yeah. I've hired and fired, I don't know how many people over my career, my professional career. And the biggest thing that I've always looked for, number one is showing up. You got to show up. Are you dependable? And what's your presentation? You know, and if you can get those three things.
Yeah, that's the professionalism aspect of they don't know what professional life is. They at a place like Hopkins, and in my class, it requires permission of the instructor to enter. So I screen everybody, and more or less the minimum grade's about a 3.7. They're all more or less straight A students.
Yeah,
but they know how to take an exam. That's all I know how to do, most of them. But the rest of it, they have no clue.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's all becoming worse. And I require a lot of writing. My courses carry what's called a W designation at Hopkins. That's writing intensive. And to graduate, you have to take so many writing intensive courses. Well, mine happens to be writing intensive, but you just can't believe the level of writing at the university now of incoming freshmen. It's unbelievable.
Well, I can actually. My wife is a professor. She's a doctor. She has a PhD, and she teaches PhD students. And she used to teach undergraduate, and she said the level of writing, I mean, she's just frustrated, if you would. And I have a family of writers, actually. I have two writers. Two of my kids are writers. And that they've made that comment that you just shared. Kids coming out of school now, unfortunately, just don't have those skills, those writing techniques and skills.
Yeah, it's really completely deteriorated. And I spend a lot of time, by the way, it's basically a student of rhetoric.
Yeah.
I spend a tremendous amount of time, and I'm going to reach back my bookshelf at home. That's the latest book on rhetoric that I've just read.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a great book. Right to the point.
Yeah.
How to be clear, correct, and persuasive on the page. That's the subtitle. So at any rate, I think writing is very important, because forces you to think. If you can't write, it's a pretty good indication that you can't think.
Well said.
And this gets in the end of the zone. Another thing, an overarching thing that I teach them, I don't indoctrinate them with my view of classical economics and free market thinking and that kind of thing. But I do think once they end up going through my courses, they have a pretty good idea of how to critically think.
Yeah. Well, that's a skill.
By the way, as an example, one of the best chiefs of staff I ever had, knew exactly the way I was thinking. And I had, you know, we working on articles at 2 or 3 in the morning. This was when I was still cranking out things 24 hours a day. And any rate, it would be at 2 in the morning and I, you know, hit kind of a slow spot and tell him what I wanted the next paragraph, and he'd draft it. And it was pretty close to where I was going. And he was left of center. We discussed it. I knew where he was. He knew where I was. He understood. But it's a critical thinking aspect of the deal. Point number one. And point number two, the guy was smart enough to be able to get into my head and figure out how to actually explain an argument as I would explain the argument. Not that he agreed with it. He often disagreed with it, but it didn't faze the guy at all. He went on to work a few years on Capitol Hill and then went to Harvard Law School, graduated a year ago in the top 10% of the class. So those are the kind of students I have and like.
Yeah. Well, if in another life, I would have loved to be your student at Hopkins, and I will try to convince one of my 5 kids, even if they can't get into Hopkins, to you need to stop by and audit one of your classes.
Oh, yeah. Wait. We can do a podcast. Listen to the podcast.
Professor Hanke, I have taken way too much of your time. I want to tell you just thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You've always been very gracious to me. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Andy. I look forward to being with you again. By the way, the next time, maybe we'll get more time to talk about a new book I wrote with Matt Sikirki, Making Money Work. We'll get to that chapter the next time we talk.
I'm making a note. Making Money Work.
Making Money Work. You might put that up on your visual with the podcast. And
I'll link
to follow me, by the way. I did mention Twitter @Steve_Hanke.
Yep. I will put that in the show notes as well. All of this will be on the YouTube, the Apple podcast, as well as Spotify. Professor, okay. I want to thank you so much for your time. I always enjoy it.
Thank you, Andy. Have a great afternoon.
You as well.
Okay. Thank you.